I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Elizabeth Warren's rising poll numbers made her the target at last night's Democratic presidential primary debate. Here's Beto O'Rourke, Tulsi Gabbard, Pete Buttigieg, and Amy Klobuchar.
I think we need to be focused on lifting people up. And sometimes I think that Senator Warren is more focused on being punitive or pitting some part of the country against the other, instead of lifting people up and making sure that this country comes together around those solutions.
I'd like to ask Senator Warren if she would join me in calling for an end to this regime change war in Syria, finally.
Look, this is why people here in the Midwest are so frustrated with Washington in general and Capitol Hill in particular. Your signature, Senator, is to have a plan for everything, except this. No plan has been laid out to explain how a multi-trillion-dollar hole in this Medicare for All plan that Senator Warren is putting forward is supposed to get filled in.
At least Bernie's being honest here and saying how he's going to pay for this and that taxes are going to go up. And I'm sorry, Elizabeth, but you have not said that. And I think we owe it to the American people to tell them where we're going to send the invoice.
Warren's response, it's time to think big. Bernie Sanders, who said he felt great after his heart attack, was true to his message last night about helping struggling Americans and taking on corporate greed. Joe Biden defended his son Hunter against President Trump's attacks and said, I'm the only one on the stage that has gotten anything really big done. Both Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar staked out a middle ground on the issues and consistently took on Warren. Cory Booker reminded his fellow Democrats that their target should be President Trump. Kamala Harris touted reproductive rights. Beto O'Rourke defended his call to confiscate assault weapons. Andrew Yang touted his signature UBI plan. Julian Castro criticized the Trump administration for caging children at the border while letting ISIS run free. Tulsi Gabbard claimed she was not a Russian asset, something she apparently was accused of being. And Tom Steyer, who was invested millions in ads calling for Trump's impeachment, said everyone on the stage was more patriotic than the, quote, criminal in the White House. That's a thumbnail sketch of last night's debate. And here to put some meat on the bones is Camille Burr. She's an assistant professor of political science at Villanova University, where her work focuses on race and psychology, emotion, politics. Camille Burr, it's nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us by Skype is Stephen Medvick. He's the Honorable and Mrs. John J. Kunkel Professor of Government at Franklin and Marshall College. Wrote a book called In Defense of Politicians, The Expectation Trap and Its Threat to Democracy. Stephen Medvick, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks very much.
And also with us and rounding out our trio of guests is Shauna Shama. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University at their Camden campus. Wrote a book called Out of the Running, Why Millennials Reject Political Careers and Why It Matters. She's got a brand new book called Survive and Resist, The Definitive Guide to Dystopian Politics. And Shauna Shama, it's nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here.
And to our listeners, as always, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Camille, let me start with you. And just sort of broadly speaking, last night, this is the fourth debate where these Democrats have taken the stage. What did you learn last night, and how would you say this debate compared to previous ones?
So in regards to how it compares to previous debates, I think that last night we got a more substantive understanding of where each of the candidates stand. In the previous debates, it was very clear that the candidates were trying to get attention, maybe attacking each other, trying to stand out in the crowds so that they could make it to some of these final rounds. But last night we were actually able to see, you know, what do the Democratic candidates think? How do they differ on key policy issues that Americans care about, and how they're drawing these distinctions between themselves and really making a case for the American people to support their vision of what they would look like in the White House or of their presidency.
A public service from your perspective?
I think so. A public service that was perhaps quite a bit too long.
And 3 hours.
And quite exhausting, right? So 3 hours over 12 issues with 12 candidates. And they were just running through these questions and topics. So as a general person, I was sitting on the sofa waiting for this to end, even though it was substantive, at times very painful.
What was your takeaway, Shauna?
I really enjoyed it. I mean, you have to be a bit of a political junkie.
Right?
I know. It's so embarrassing. But I felt like I'd watched kind of like a good sports game after. It had that feeling of like, okay, both teams played really well. I felt like a lot of the candidates did well. It was a pleasure to see the kind of remaining people on one stage. It's been hard, I think, to compare over two nights. That's a tough thing. So I enjoyed that. 12 people is still too many for one stage, and that made it exhausting. It also kind of gave an incentive for a lot of the lower polling candidates to try to have a moment and to break out. And I hate that kind of posturing and that performative aspect. But I think Camille's right. It's the most substantive that we've seen anybody do so far, even though I didn't love the kind of 15-second response format.
Yeah, it's hard to get into some details. How about for you, Stephen? What was your takeaway?
I'd agree with most of what my colleagues have said. I think this was a substantive debate. I think we learned a lot about what the candidates think they need to do going forward. So there was a lot of, I think, positioning and jockeying to sort of get in, as people say, in certain lanes, right? And so Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are clearly in the progressive lane of these primaries. But everybody else is trying to position themselves, I think, as the alternative to them in the Biden lane. And so I think in particular, Buttigieg and Klobuchar had really good nights as coming forward as somebody who can be an alternative to Elizabeth Warren, but who's not Joe Biden.
Well, let me ask us all about Joe Biden. And I'll start with you, Stephen, since you mentioned his name. Mm-hmm. The Biden lane, just how narrow is that lane, do you think, today?
Well, I mean, it's probably going to be quite crowded. I mean, you know, Biden's there. And right now, I mean, he doesn't seem to be really losing any steam. I mean, if you look at sort of national averages in the polls, he's exactly where he was on the eve of his announcement of his candidacy. So he's sort of maintaining the strong position he's had from the very beginning. But I think there are some doubts, you know, about the strength of his candidacy, maybe going forward and in a general election. And so there may be room for somebody like Mayor Buttigieg or Senator Klobuchar, maybe Booker or Harris to sort of fill that gap. But it's interesting that nobody's really, except maybe Congressman O'Rourke, no one's really trying to overtake the two progressive, you know, leaders.
Well, let me tell this to you, Camille. And as I understand it, for Joe Biden, the support he has is among older Democrats and also among African Americans.
I think his support is among older Democrats. It's among working class white individuals. So when he's running with Barack Obama in 08 and 12, we get Joe Biden going into a lot of the factories and bringing up his background narrative as a scrappy kid from Scranton. And so I think that he does have favor, especially with white voters. I think that his favor with voters of color is only there maybe perhaps because of his connection with Barack Obama. As more people start to talk about the crime bill of the 90s and how Joe Biden was the sole author of the crime bill, I think that is fairly off-putting to African-American voters. But at the end of the day, it's about the candidate that is going to be able to bring together a very diverse Democratic coalition. That's suburban white women, that's millennials, that's people of color, that's members of the LGBTQIA community. And Joe Biden, to a certain extent, has some of those coalitions in check, but definitely not all of them. And I think the fact that Elizabeth Warren is surging in some polls and that Joe Biden is a bit stagnant suggests that he doesn't have those coalitions as tightly bound, maybe perhaps as he thought.
Shawna, you've written about millennials. I don't want you to be here to represent all millennials, but from that perspective, and when you look at the front runners, they're all in their 70s, and that includes President Trump. How do you think young people are looking at these candidates, and even beyond the four older ones?
So the biggest problem I think Hillary had with young voters in 2016 is that they felt like she was part of a dynasty, and that really hurt her.
They didn't want that.
They did not want that. They did not want politics as usual. Sanders looked like an outsider. I think he still does. But now it's Biden who looks like kind of he's been in the White House. And I think to my students, at least, that's not what they're looking for. They want something new. So I think particularly race and gender are good outsider signals. And this is the most diverse set of primary candidates we've ever seen in the Democratic Party. It's exciting to see kind of some real diversity up on that stage. So to see Pete Buttigieg, to see Warren and Kamala Harris and Cory Booker not just represent visually their diversity, but also kind of play to those issue strengths. Mm-hmm. I think that's important for millennials to see.
And to use the words, right?
To use the words, absolutely. And to be kind of out about their identity and how that identity affects their issues. The fact about the polling, though, is that it's been so split among so many candidates that right now, as more and more candidates start dropping out, I think that's where the support for Warren is coming from. And I think you're going to see more support for these other candidates and less for Biden, especially among young people.
Stephen, let me get you back in on the conversation. And frankly, one of the reasons we wanted to have you on is because you know Pennsylvania so well. We are apparently going to be, if not a, maybe the battleground state. As you were watching last night and thinking about Pennsylvania voters, who do you think Pennsylvania voters, broadly speaking, were resonating with?
That's a really very good question. And I don't think there's a clear answer, because you can kind of slice it lots of different ways. I mean, the traditional way of thinking about it is that Biden has, you know, some connection to the state. He appeals to lots of the voters in this, a big chunk of the voters in the state, white working class voters. But, you know, one of the problems in 2016 was that there just wasn't excitement among the Democratic base in the state, especially in places like Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, for Hillary Clinton. And so what I think the Democrats are going to need in 2020 is somebody who can excite their base and mobilize their voters. And so really what we're kind of talking about here is electability. Right. And I try to tell people, my students, not to think too much about electability, because it's nearly impossible to predict. Back in 2015, we would have said the least electable candidate was probably Donald Trump, and now he's president, right? So it's hard to judge exactly who's electable and who's not. But if you think about Biden, you know, he's electable in the sense that he may appeal to some moderate voters, some centrist and independent voters. On the other hand, he may turn off part of the base, whereas a Warren or a Buttigieg or someone else is likely to excite the base and to make up for any loss maybe in the center or with, you know, some of the traditional swing voters.
Well, I know you want to say something, Camille. We're almost up on a break here, so hold on to that thought and we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about last night's debate among 12 Democratic candidates who want to be the nominee for president. Talking with Stephen Medvick, he's a professor of government at Franklin and Marshall College. Shauna Shamas, a professor of political science at Rutgers University at their Camden campus. And Camille Burge, she's an assistant professor of political science at Villanova University. And we want to hear from you if you stayed up late, as most of us did. I bailed at 10 to talk about the debate. We want to hear from you. What was your takeaway? Radio Times at WHYY.org. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Put a comment on our Facebook page or call us 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times. Here on WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Again, talking about last night's debate among the 12 Democrats who want to win the nomination to be the person representing their party to take on President Trump. Camille, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, so we left off with Stephen talking about excitement and enthusiasm and trying to figure out which candidate that is. I mean, the thing that I think people should know is just about the level of excitement on the Republican side to reelect President Trump. I feel like that's something that people are not talking about. When he made his reelection announcement in Florida, people slept outside for days waiting in line. When the impeachment inquiry was brought up and Speaker Pelosi made her announcement, millions of dollars were raised within about a week. And so there's a great deal of red Republican conservative enthusiasm to keep Donald Trump in office, to reelect him. And so the Democrats really need to figure it out and fairly quick, a candidate or pair of candidates that the party and members of the party can coalesce around and can get excited about turning out to vote for before it's too late, before we split the party 12 ways. And we don't necessarily know which direction the coalitions are going to go in.
Just a quick follow up. Right. Do you think it's more, I mean, not that people can't chew gum and walk at the same time, but do you think it's more important for Democrats to say, I can beat this guy, or to say, these are some of the bread and butter issues and we're going to really work on them?
I think it's both. Right. And so I think the strategy, like, I'm going to beat Donald Trump, or I'm the lesser of two evils that Hillary Clinton deployed in her campaign, is not as effective as they think it should be, because there are a significant amount of American people that support the current president's agenda. Right. And so I think it's both. It's saying, I can beat this candidate, but I also have a vision for the American people. And that is why people should turn out to vote for me.
Sean, I know you wanted to add something as well. And Stephen, I hear you making noises. Yep, I'll get you in as well. So hold on to that thought. Shauna, go ahead.
Well, I thought Cory Booker said it very well in the debate. He said this debate should be about what we're for and not who we're against. And I think that's right. And standing up for key Democratic issues and constituencies will show both who the Democrats are for and, I think, a path to winning in 2020. So particularly I was impressed in the debate with kind of moments of moral outrage.
Such as
Castro talking about caging children at the border. I mean, it's galling. It is just kind of obscene that we are doing this here in America. And it does fire up the Democratic base to see their leaders take a stand. So that's why there's been a lot of excitement about the impeachment, to see Kamala Harris talk about the story about her mother sitting at the kitchen table after everybody else has gone to bed, trying to balance the budget. How do I make this all work? She says justice is on the ballot. And those kinds of stirring moments from the debate. Booker talking about the violence of child poverty. I'd never heard it in those terms, and I loved that line. So I think those candidates are giving us kind of a moral imperative that if other Democrats would follow it through, will fire up the base and boost turnout in a way that we need to see happen. For me, this election is all about turnout.
Well, but you're saying some of this inspiring language versus, you know, a 10-point plan to deal with health care, that we can't forget some of those words or moments of inspiration?
I think you can have a plan and inspiration. So I don't mean to say that Warren, because she has a plan for that,
she does.
Does not have inspiration. I think she absolutely does. But those are the moments. Klobuchar had a few, too, where she talked about her grandfather in the coal mines and that he wouldn't be alive except for the union. I found those powerful moments last night.
Stephen, go ahead. I know you want to say some things.
Yeah, I was just going to follow up on what Camille said, which I think is a really important point. I mean, it's often the case that, you know, when a party holds the White House, their voters get a little bit lackadaisical. You know, they've already won the big prize. And so turnout is maybe especially hard on their side. But this year, it seems as though Republicans are going to be every bit as energized as they were in 2016, maybe in part because, or definitely in part because of impeachment. But they're really going to be activated. And so I think Camille's right. The Democrats really have to think hard about what kind of candidate do they put forward to sort of match that enthusiasm. I think one of the really interesting exchanges last night, Marty, you may have missed it if you checked
out. I did.
I
true confessions. I bailed at 10. But right. Anyway, go ahead, Stephen.
So it was a question about candidate's vision of the party and what kind of candidate they thought the party needed to put forward. And you know, Biden sort of said it's got to be somebody who can get things done. Interestingly, he didn't really talk about electability. Klobuchar did. Klobuchar pointed out that she wins red parts of her state all the time, that she's very successful in a very purple state. And so she made the case for a more pragmatic case. So did Biden, to some extent, Buttigieg did too. Warren and Sanders, of course, said, we're not going to win this if we just talk about who can get things done, if we're pragmatic. So they made the case that we have to have inspiring, exciting ideas, or we're just not going to be able to compete.
Let me read a couple of comments. A Facebook comment from Mac who says, one of these candidates is going to have to step up, forget the I'm not Donald Trump line, and espouse a realistic platform that can get him or her elected. It won't be easy because the country is in good shape economically. Brendan says, this is an email. I'm a millennial Sanders Warren supporter and would not vote for Biden in a general election. I know a lot of my friends feel the same way. A question from Matthew. Can your guest speak to the shift in polls away from Biden and towards the progressive candidates like Sanders and Warren? And Camille, can I go back to you, although I'd like to hear from all of you. And it is interesting, and I know on Sunday, Bernie Sanders said, Elizabeth, as you know, has said she is a capitalist. I am not. But they are sort of carving out this more progressive, more left part of the Democratic Party. How do you see the two of them?
So I think going back to Shauna's comment earlier when we were talking is incredibly instructive here, that as more people drop out, we are seeing this support for Elizabeth Warren increase. And in my mind, the flag that I'm seeing is while her numbers are increasing, Joe Biden's are not, right? So from the beginning, from the time he announces, he's already at 20-ish percent, and that's where he still is. And that suggests that I think Elizabeth Warren, at least over the next few months, will most likely be the momentum candidate. I read an article on 538 this morning talking about the amount of times that Fox News mentions various Democratic candidates. And so one of the things that they found is that in the last week, because they do it every week, that Elizabeth Warren's mentions have increased by 7.3%, and Joe Biden's mentions have decreased by 3.6%. And that to me is significant because not only are people polling that are Democrats starting to move towards Elizabeth Warren or even moving towards Elizabeth Warren in ways in which they're not Joe Biden, even more conservative outlets are starting to identify individuals that they may think are front runners in the Democratic Party. And so I think that all of those things coming together will suggest that at least for the next month or two, that she'll see a sizable bump in polling numbers.
Shauna, I have to say that I thought Bernie Sanders looked great last night. I thought he actually looked a little more relaxed. He joked a couple of times. He smiled. I felt like it was a same message, but a slightly different persona or performance. What did you see?
May we all look so good after a heart attack. I know, I agree.
Yes.
No, I thought in some ways it seemed to give him kind of a new lease on life. He was raring to go. I think he kind of knows the importance of broadcasting health at this moment. That's what he's doing. I thought he really did look strong, that he could stand up there for 3 hours and argue, I thought, spoke well for him. So I wanted to get back to the kind of staking out positions.
Sure.
That Stephen taught about, the kind of putting themselves in lanes is a great way to put it. Sanders and Warren are fighting over the more progressive wing right now. But I think Warren kind of had a great moment in the debate where she show that she can be both practical and inspirational, right? Because she was right up there with Sanders saying, we've got to think big. We've got to make big changes. It's not worth trying to fix healthcare and then only putting a Band-Aid on it. So in some ways, they were aligned and they were in the leftmost lane. But when Biden goes into his kind of speech about, you know, I'm the only one up here who's gotten anything done, and Warren kind of says, excuse me, Consumer Protection Bureau, right? I have gotten something done, and they told me it was too big a dream. I got it done. I thought that was terrific.
Well, she even added to that where he said, well, I voted for it, and she thanked right. President Obama, but she omitted
Vice President.
I
think everybody
President
who has worked on this, right. I think it was a signal saying he may have worked on this, but it was not his baby.
Right. Well, Stephen, let me add Pete Buttigieg, because he really took on Elizabeth Warren on this health care, where he talks about his plan of Medicare for all who want it, saying Americans want a choice. Not to get too much in the weeds here, but again, he seems to be, and maybe because he's a Midwesterner and a mayor, he's sort of carving out something in the middle to the center of these more progressive candidates.
Yeah, he is. And he's been very impressive throughout the campaign. And the question is just, again, where does he fit in this scheme of things? Now, in national polls, he's at 5 or 6%. Right. But I think the national polls are they're not irrelevant because they're important for money and for endorsements and things like that. But we really have to start to look at Iowa and New Hampshire. And Buttigieg has a chance to make a showing in Iowa. And if he does well, if he finishes in the top three, you know, who knows what will happen after that in New Hampshire or going forward. My sense is, though, I mean, Warren, again, is you know, she has the momentum. She's doing really well in Iowa and New Hampshire. She's now in the lead there. If she were to win both of those, it's hard to imagine she wouldn't have a fairly clear path to the nomination. I mean, it depends on what happens to Biden's voters. I mean, would Biden collapse at that point, or do roughly a third of the voters stick with Biden? And so you can also imagine a scenario where going forward, I don't think Sanders is going to gain much. I don't think he's going to lose much either. So he sits at around 15 or 16 percentage points. If Biden's at about a third of the electorate and Warren's around that same number, you know, this could drag on for quite a while. But at some point, it's going to winnow. There's going to be only three, maybe four candidates really left standing. And then who knows? Mm. It's a little bit unpredictable. You know, who knows what would happen at that point? Like I said, Biden, you could imagine just sort of collapsing if Warren does really well in early contests.
Let me just quickly reintroduce everybody. That's Stephen Medvick, also with us Camille Burge and Shauna Shamus, and we are talking about last night's debate among the Democrats. And we want to hear from you. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Also curious about if there is a particular candidate that you think is the one that can become president of the United States. We want to know what you think about that. Dan says, whoever gets the nomination can have as many ideas as they want, but unless the Democrats take the Senate, it won't matter. Mm. I mean, Camille, there is some truth to that. I mean,
some truth, right? And some of the proposals that we saw last night even suggested that if they don't take the Senate, executive action will be taken to ensure that their agenda is carried out. Kamala Harris said this, and a few other candidates as well, making sure that they take the steps to get necessary things done related to things like gun control or reproductive rights. And so I don't think it's a lose-all case if they don't take back the Senate. I think it's an issue if they lose the entire Congress, then we have something to talk about. But if they maintain at least one chamber, I think that they'll be fine.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. A question from Rachel. Do your guests think that there was a strategy behind AOC, Omar, and Tlaib endorsing Sanders last night? Let me toss that to you, Shauna. My understanding is that AOC is going to endorse Sanders. I'm not sure that they've all signed on, but how significant do you think that is, or is it?
I don't see it as hugely significant. It's a moment, and it certainly kind of will shore up his support for young people who are really interested in these particular women of color congresswomen. In terms of, I don't think it was a concerted strategy, but I do think that policy-wise, maybe those congresswomen are trying to vocalize their support for a growing movement that I see among young people and my students, which is kind of embracing democratic socialism. And they see Bernie as kind of the maybe the best mouthpiece for that. My students, one of them told me directly, well, the reason we haven't voted is there's nothing to vote for. And now there is. So I think that gets them excited in a moment politically when my students are very depressed about the state of the world, about the state of the wars that we're in, about the way that the economy works, the way that healthcare works, and particularly about climate change, right? So that they feel like they're being handed a broken country. And I think they think that democratic socialism gives us a way forward, whereas they haven't seen one represented before.
Let me go back to you, Stephen, and again, someone who understands Pennsylvania. How do you think democratic socialism plays in the Commonwealth?
Well, I mean, for older voters, I think the phrase socialism is still fairly scary. I think, you know, for millennials and younger, they just didn't have the same experience of going through the Cold War. They don't think of socialism in the same terms. And, you know, they're as likely to think of Denmark or Scandinavian countries, you know, when they think of socialism as they are of the old Soviet Union. So, you know, I think it depends on the voters. I mean, it's probably not a net plus to have to defend socialist positions, which is why I think Senator Warren has said, you know, that she's for what she said last night, accountable capitalism, mm-hmm. that she's a capitalist to her bones. I mean, I think that's why she's saying that. But look, this endorsement, I think, for Senator Sanders, I do think the timing of the announcement of it was strategic. I think they wanted to follow, you know, right on the edge of the debate when people are paying attention. And I think it's true that endorsements are sometimes overrated, but they can signal to activists in the party what some people that they trust, some elected officials that they trust are thinking. And so if AOC and representatives Tlaib and Omar think that Sanders is the best way forward, that's going to be a fairly powerful message, I think, for a lot of activists in the party.
I mean, Camille, I would think AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, has a lot of clout in the Democratic Party.
I think their endorsement may motivate coalitions in the party that Democrats need in terms of turnout. But I'm also thinking of what this looks like from the other side, right? So how are Republicans perceiving this endorsement of Bernie Sanders by these new women of color who are being painted as the new Hillary Clinton's or Barack Obama's, right? And so what I think that does for even Democratic moderates who are somewhere in the middle is it says, like, I don't know if I'm willing to go to that extreme. And then also for Republicans who are looking at this from the other side, I think it's the perfect move because they're saying there's no way that with the backing of these four women who the Republican Party has already deemed as, you know, outliers, complete socialists on the extremes of what the American public want, they too recognize that this move was probably going to work in their favor, that perhaps there's no way that Democrats would coalesce around this candidate, not all Democrats, but a significant amount.
Sure. Right. Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about last night's debate among 12 Democrats looking to be the nominee for president. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking about last night's debate, what the candidates said, their positions on some of the issues, how well they made their case, and what the primary race will look like with the Iowa caucuses still 4 months away. Camille Burge, an assistant professor of political science at Villanova University, Stephen Medvick, professor of government at Franklin and Marshall College, and Shona Shamus is a professor of political science at Rutgers University, Camden. I'm going to say on the air, Shona, what you were saying off the air as we were chatting during that 90-second break. You said this is a terrible process. Explain.
Well, ever since the McGovern Commission report in 1972, which followed the kind of tumultuous 68 Democratic convention in Chicago, we've had this very open primary system. And in some ways, that's what the party members wanted. They wanted to have voice and they wanted to have a say in who the nominee is. But boy, we've not figured out how to do it well. And I'm just kind of watching the people beat each other to death in primary after primary. It's a terrible process because it looks like a free-for-all, right? Nobody ever wins in a free-for-all. And even the eventual nominee, when they emerge, is kind of heavily bruised. What you can get in a kind of a plurality voting system that we're using. Where
meaning
just like,
winner takes all?
Right. Well, it's the winner takes all, but they can win with less than 50% of the votes. So this is how Donald Trump became the Republican Party nominee when almost nobody but about a third of the Republican Party, and not just the Republican Party primary voters, which is a small slice of the party. So a third of Republican Party primary voters put Donald Trump as the nominee. It's a terrible process because we could do this differently. We could use preferential balloting, sometimes called instant runoff voting, to see, all right, so maybe I like Warren and you like Harris. Let's rate them. If you could vote for Warren and then Harris and then Booker, and we could, you know, we could use the kind of voting and data tools that we have far better.
Stephen, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I think this is a really important point. You know, the main problem I think that Shauna's pointing to is that it's that the party establishment has lost complete control of this process. And, you know, in some ways, we're never going to put the genie back in the bottle. I mean, Democratic activists, rank and file activists in both parties want much more say, and they don't want the National Committee to sort of put a thumb on the scale and tilt the outcome in the direction of a handful of candidates. They want this sort of free-for-all. For a while, there was good political science evidence that suggested the party establishment figured out how to put a thumb on the scale without being obvious about it. And that was sending all the endorsements to one candidate. And again, that would send a signal to voters that, like, look, this is who we think is going to be the best candidate and the best president at the end of the day. That seems to have fallen apart in the last couple of election cycles, and there's a bunch of reasons for that. Chief among them is really changes to campaign finance system, but also to the rise of social media, right? So candidates now can create an organization from nothing. And so I think Sean is absolutely right. This process is kind of nuts, and we have to think about how we might sort of make it a little bit more rational going forward.
Camille, let me put something else on the table here. Who do you think President Trump wants to take on among the Democrats? Now, Joe Biden seemed to be saying he wants me, and that's why he's going after me and my son with this whole Ukraine thing. But who do you think, as he looks at this, you know, I think we're up to 20, but there were 12 on the stage last night. When he looks at them, who do you think is the one that he would prefer to take on? And I'm asking you, of course, to get inside his head. It's not fair.
I think based on all of the things that I've seen, all of the tweets, I think he'd like to take on Elizabeth Warren, right? Only because I think he's waiting to throw in the Pocahontas rhetoric, right? And he's waiting to draw distinctions between what some would perceive to be her more extreme or more progressive views of what the country should look like as opposed to where he's currently sitting. And so I think to him, she would be the perfect foil because it's very easy to say, look at where she is in terms of being so far to the left. Like, I'm willing to at least consider some new ways to think about things. But the American people are wholly, probably most likely not going to get on board with that agenda. And so I think that along with the little digs pertaining mm-hmm. to the ancestry test, I think he's just lying in wait for her to quite possibly be the representative, her or someone like Bernie Sanders, who recently received the endorsement from the four women of color, again, so he can like tout the extremism of the Democratic Party and suggest that they are not on par with what the overwhelming majority of Americans want.
I mean, he seems to be very gifted at finding people's vulnerabilities, but I wonder then having to get asking you, Camille, to get then into Elizabeth Warren's head. I mean, do you think she will take it?
I think
fight it.
I think Elizabeth Warren is ready for this fight. I mean, I have not been watching a great deal of the previous debates. I watched the one that preceded this one. But Elizabeth Warren has a way of connecting to people that I don't see with other candidates on the stage. She has a very academic way of breaking down complex issues into small, manageable pieces so that people can understand. So last night during the debate, when she's talking about income inequality and the wealth tax, I could see that she saw herself getting like a little out in the field, a little out in the numbers. And she goes, let's bring this down, right? So like 25% at this dollar, and then talking about what does this mean in terms of universal health care and bringing it down to really relatable chunks that the American people can understand. And I think her ability to do that, her ability to consume lots of different types of information and to come up with really great answers on the spot, I think that she would be a great person to watch debate President Trump, just to look at how different their answers might be in terms of substance. So I think she would be, of all the candidates, I think she would be particularly well equipped for this fight, for these debates.
I do want to read some comments, but just quickly, Sean, is there someone that you think is the best to take on President Trump?
Well, honestly, Marty, I've been thinking about this geographically, and I'm very concerned that either a West or an East Coaster would be fairly easy to dismiss and might have trouble getting the middle. That's part of why Biden has looked really good as a potential nominee, is that he's got these Scranton roots and he's got kind of a blue-collar upbringing. And, you know, he can certainly bring in more from the middle of the country. I was really impressed with Amy Klobuchar last night and her kind of Midwestern common sense approach, her practicalism. I didn't agree with all of her policies, but I think she is somebody people would trust, and that's a big issue for voters right now. And she and Pete Buttigieg come from the middle of the country.
They do.
I really liked O'Rourke for a while for that reason. Also, I want to see more Democrats from red states that could potentially realign the electoral map a little bit. So maybe some of these people are now running for vice president. I hope they are in the consideration. I was just looking at the candidates up there last night. I was thinking this could be a great cabinet and ticket, right? You could just arrange all of
put
these
them
people.
Put them all in various seats,
absolutely,
right, around the table.
And so far none of them have an incentive to do that.
Right.
But maybe whoever's the front runner could start asking them. But I want to capture the middle of the country and not just the coasts.
Stephen, you want to add to that?
I think it is the case that if just on paper, if you look at these candidates, I think the most difficult candidate for President Trump to face would be Amy Klobuchar. I mean, I don't really know how he would attack her.
Right.
She's likable. She's trustworthy. She comes from a state that is, you know, that is really competitive, and she has had great success there. So I think she would be pretty formidable. I think he probably does want to run against Elizabeth Warren, but be careful what you wish for, right? I mean, Hillary Clinton wanted to run against Donald Trump too. So I think Warren would be tougher than he thinks she would be. I do think, and I think one thing that came up last night that she's going to have to come up with, has to have an answer for, is this question about how do you pay for your health care plan?
Right.
And she refuses to say that taxes will go up on the middle class, but overall costs will come down. She simply wants to say overall cost comes down. And that just looks like it's evasive. And I think Mayor Buttigieg kind of took her to task on that last night. And that's going to be something that dogs her for a while unless she gets a better answer to that question.
In fact, now, I think it was Amy Klobuchar said, well, at least Bernie Sanders is being honest about
exactly.
that he would actually raise taxes. Did you want to add something, Camille?
So in terms of Amy Klobuchar, she looks good on paper, but Hillary Clinton also looked good on paper, right? And for me, the larger issue for Amy Klobuchar that we've been talking about over our last few minutes together is electability and enthusiasm. In her comments, aside from bringing up the fact that she was from the Midwest and the blue wall needs to come back together, she tried to have these relatable moments. And every time I just cringed, right? So like talking about Russian meddling in terms of that's not meddling, you know, calling my daughter on a Saturday night, that's meddling. Or her father, who had been sober for many years and asking where he could get a drink in the assisted living facility.
What he thought about
right,
that
exactly.
comment.
And so it's just like when those moments happened, right, I was like, oh, you know, I was feeling the cringe for her. And so my heart, I think she would be a great opponent. However, I don't know how you get the rest of the Democratic Party, maybe outside side of the blue wall, excited about this kind of candidate. And I wish her the best.
Yes.
Maybe I wish her the absolute best. But I mean, I'm just not convinced that the party would rally behind her.
Sean, anything you want to add?
The last thing just to think about is we've talked about these candidates in a way as being genderless, and I want to bring gender into the conversation because I honestly think Trump has a problem with powerful women. And that's part of why I would love to see a Klobuchar or a Warren or a Harris against him, because I watched him trying to figure out how to deal with Nancy Pelosi. And he got...
He doesn't have a nickname for her, by
the way. He doesn't have a nickname for her. I think he's a little bemused by women who are not either kind of in the mother realm or the sex object realm. Like, he doesn't quite know what to do or how to relate to them. I think he'd rather face Joe Biden, actually. But I want to see him go against a powerful woman.
Let me read a couple of comments here. Cynthia says, I'm leaning towards Andrew Yang. I believe his idea of universal income, and I support his stance on gun control. But when I think about the ideology of Trump's base, I'm not sure that an Asian American is electable right now. An email from Susan, Biden is a moderate, but his career is marked by strong foreign policy, early protection for women and families, and empathetic kindness. Day one, he can repair the damage and put us back on course. Dan says, why are we still talking about Biden so much when he lost against Trump with a centrist campaign last, excuse me, a centrist candidate last time? So sort of a little bit of a thumbnail sketch about how some of our listeners are thinking. Tom, let me ask you just quickly, Stephen, about Tom Steyer, his first time on the stage. Frankly, I forgot he was there most of the time, but right. What did you, in 30 seconds or less, what did you think about him?
Like a lot of people, I wasn't crazy about the scotch tape tie, but aside from that, I thought, I thought Steyer had a pretty good command of the issue. So there were a couple of questions that got tossed his way, and I thought, I'm not sure he really knows much about that issue, but he seemed to have a pretty good command. I mean, he does bring things back a lot to democratic reform. And so I don't agree with all of his proposals for democratic reform, but he does say, part of the problem here is just a corrupt system, and we've got to fix that if we're going to fix gun control or gun violence or all the other host of issues that we're dealing with. So he's got a message that he's sticking with. I'm not sure how far it's going to take him.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Camille, you had a response. Do you have anything you want to say on the radio?
I'm okay. I mean, In terms of Steyer or just the debate
just,
at large?
Well, we have a couple minutes, but Steyer, anything else?
I thought Steyer was giving us some really interesting inside ball on billionaires. So the question, like, I'm the only billionaire on stage here, and here's how I feel about these things. Like, there are so many loopholes in this tax policy. Like, they're absolutely right. So the things that I valued most about Steyer, even though on a 538 article it suggested that he spoke the less in terms of the amount of words, he had the least words of anyone on the stage last night. But more impactful words. So bringing up climate change when that wasn't necessarily like brought up in a prompt. Also telling the American people like how these relationships work with billionaires and other industries and donating money to candidates and corporations and finance inside of politics. So what I appreciated most about him was some of the more inside ball information that he gave us that at times weren't necessarily on topic, but fairly insightful, which is what I got from him last night.
We don't often get to hear from billionaires,
right, exactly.
is what you're saying. Shauna, we're almost out of time here. I'd be curious about your final thoughts. Even as we think ahead to, I guess it's November and the next debate, they're going to increase the threshold, I think, closer to 5% as opposed to 2% in terms of polling. But nonetheless, thoughts as we close out the hour?
The demographics of America right now are shifting fairly rapidly so that the millennial generation and those below them are so much more racially and ethnically diverse, so much more diverse in terms of gender identity, so much more progressive than their older counterparts, that I'm concerned that this kind of terrible free-for-all primary process may not reflect the demographics of America. That said, part of the problem is that my students don't vote at the same rates as older Americans. So for me, like I said before, this is all about turnout. I really hope young people will vote both in the primaries and the general, even if they don't love whatever candidate emerges. The greater turnout will be Democrats' victory.
Stephen, 20 seconds, final thought.
Sure. I guess the final thought is that lots of Democrats are thinking that this is all about electability, but that's a tricky, tricky thing to figure out. So I would put that aside and I'd say which candidate excites you the most? I mean, there are a lot of candidates on that stage with a lot of ideas. Who excites you the most? They're probably going to excite other voters as well. And that may be actually the key to electability in the fall.
Well, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Time. Stephen Medvick, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Camille Burge, thank you for coming in as well.
Thank you for having me again.
You're welcome. And Shauna Shames, thank you for joining us on Radio Time.
Such a pleasure.
And Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.